This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
The United Nations warns time is running out for millions of people in Somalia who are on the brink of famine. The world body is urging the international community to rapidly respond to its $825 million appeal to stave off a catastrophe in that drought-stricken and conflict-ridden country.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. We'll have details coming up. Also, refugees in Kenya, as well as Somalis living in Nairobi, react to U.S. President Donald Trump's executive order banning Somali and Sudanese nationals. And more than 19,000 migrants have arrived in Europe so far this year by making the dangerous crossing of the Mediterranean Sea. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, well, time is running out for millions of people in Somalia who are on the brink of famine, warns the United Nations. The world body is urging the international community to rapidly respond to its $825 million appeal to stave off a catastrophe in that drought-stricken and conflict-ridden country. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
6.2 million people in Somalia, half the population, are in need of humanitarian assistance, according to the UN. To highlight the crisis, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who had been visiting Kenya, made an impromptu change of plans and traveled to Somalia. There, he met with President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed, known as Farmajo, and visited a local hospital where malnourished people are receiving treatment. The UN Director of Information in Geneva, Alessandra Vellucci, says Guterres considers it vital that he personally address this life-altering crisis.
He decided to go on an emergency visit to Mogadishu, to Somalia, in order to focus on famine and cholera. He said in a tweet this morning, "People are dying. The world must act now to stop this."
UN Emergency Relief Coordinator Stephen O'Brien arrived Monday. The United Nations reports nearly 3 million people are going hungry and need urgent life-saving relief. It warns almost 1 million children under the age of 5 will be acutely malnourished this year, including 185,000 who are at risk of dying if they do not receive immediate medical treatment. Over a recent two-day period, Somali officials report 110 people, many of them women and children, died from waterborne diseases as a result of the ongoing drought. Jens Laerke is the spokesman for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. He says there are worrying similarities in some parts of Somalia to the 2011 famine, which killed 260,000 people. He tells VOA it is hard to predict when this growing catastrophe could turn into a full-blown famine.
It's a creeping disaster. It creeps up on you day by day. It gets a little bit worse. So how much time do we have? Well, if we stopped operations right now today, people would start dying tomorrow. That is one way of looking at it. So how much time do we have? Very little time.
Laerke says the Somalia appeal has received $100 million in contributions and more in pledges. While that is good, he says it is not good enough as more support is urgently needed. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. Well, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says Somalia needs massive support to prevent a repeat of the 2011 famine that killed 260,000 people. Guterres made a surprise visit today to Somalia. He met with newly elected President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo, as well as UN and African Union officials. He says 6.2 million people are in need of humanitarian assistance in Somalia, almost half of the Somali population. Later in the day, Guterres flew to Baidoa, one of the most drought-stricken areas in the country. Baidoa was called the City of Death in the 1990s because of the high rate of malnourishment and starvation. U.S. President Donald Trump signed a revised executive order yesterday banning Somali and Sudanese nationals, among others, from obtaining visas for 90 days, and all refugees must wait 120 days. VOA's Jill Craig spoke with refugees in Kenya, as well as Somalis living in Nairobi, to find out how they feel about the news.
The new travel order calls for a 90-day suspension of admissions for people from six Muslim-majority countries, including Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen, if they do not already have visas. The ban, coming 6 weeks after Trump's original order, which was blocked by federal courts, takes effect March 16th. 42-year-old Ahmed Omar Bihi is a Somali refugee who has lived in Kenya's Kakuma refugee camp for 5 years, after he was transferred from the Dadaab refugee camp, his home since he fled Somalia in 1992. He says it is difficult for him to stay in a refugee camp while so many of his friends are in the United States.
Yeah, it's most of our neighbors, most of our colleagues, most of our friends are living there, having a good job, having a good education, having a new wife and new life. So I feel very, 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 very traumatic when I see their pictures from there talking to me, just the condolences, condoling with me, saying that Trump will change his mind.
Another refugee, 25-year-old Chalia Rose, has lived in Kakuma for the last 15 years, since she fled South Sudan. Although South Sudan is not on the banned country list, Rose's refugee status would preclude her from obtaining a visa for 120 days if she was in the pipeline for resettlement. She says she is still hoping for the chance to come to the United States in order to obtain both an undergraduate and a master's degree so that she might someday return to South Sudan and help her country.
People who are hopeless, they at least got hope. But now when this ban is there, it's going to make them lose hope. I'll not even feel good because I won't get that chance, because I was also thinking I might get the chance of going out to fulfill my dream and to make my dreams to come true one day.
University student Mohamed Abdullahi lives in Nairobi. He says that keeping Somalia on the list of banned countries will only hurt anti-terrorism efforts against Al-Shabaab.
So once you have added at least Somalia, it will give a very strong boost to the ideology of Al-Shabaab. If USA, that was supporting your government, rejected you guys to go and visit their country, what will be the next move? So Al-Shabaab is going to have the opportunity to call for what? New recruits against the Western.
Human Rights Watch released a statement saying that the order will scapegoat refugees and send a message that Muslims are not welcome in the U.S. It further stated that the new order cannot escape the statements from Trump as candidate and president indicating the prejudicial intent to bar the entry of Muslims as a religious category. Arguing that the new executive order will disrupt thousands of lives due to terrorism fears without factual basis, the U.S. director of the Norwegian Refugee Council said that the process of refugee resettlement should be orderly, not an emotional roller coaster. Addressing a limited pool of reporters on Monday, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, Department of Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly, and Attorney General Jeff Sessions called the move critical to U.S. national security. As threats to our security continue to evolve and change, Tillerson said, common sense dictates that we continue to reevaluate and reassess the systems that we rely on to protect our country. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
More than 19,000 migrants have arrived in Europe so far this year by making the dangerous crossing of the Mediterranean Sea. The International Organization for Migration says over 15,000 of them arrived in Italy, up 9,000 compared to a year ago. The rest landed in Spain and Greece. At least 521 migrants have died trying to make the crossing. The IOM also reports that fighting between rival human smuggling gangs in Libya has left at least 22 people dead. All the dead were sub-Saharan Africans and are believed to be migrants and not gang members. More than 100 people were wounded. Also, AP reports that European Court of Justice, Europe's top court, has ruled that member countries are not required to grant humanitarian visas to those who want to enter their territory to apply for asylum. However, individual member courts could continue to grant such visas if they choose. The EU also also has adopted new rules to check everyone crossing borders, even EU nationals, against customs, crime, and visa databases. In related migrant news, Hungarian lawmakers have approved legislation to set up detention camps for asylum seekers who cross into the country illegally. Prime Minister Viktor Orbán defended the move, calling the recent influx of immigrants a Trojan horse of terrorism. Hungary has plans to shut down all of its refugee reception centers. Fifteen minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Well, the transatlantic slave trade lasted nearly 400 years, during which about 17 million people were taken from their homes and sold into bondage. Many Africans died during the ocean crossing. Many more were brought to the Americas and Caribbean, where they labored and died on plantations. The U.S. is leading an effort to protect slave-related sites and antiquities. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports on a workshop scheduled for April in Charleston, South Carolina.
Before and during the American Civil War, it was common for posters to announce slave auctions in southern towns and cities. For example, in Charleston, one proclaimed a choice cargo of about 250 slaves, described as fine and healthy, and it stated the utmost care has been taken to keep them free of smallpox. A bill of sale from the state of Georgia in August 1864 says a slave named Henry was sold for $3,000. The seller warrants him sound and healthy in mind and body, and slave for life. Another documents the sale of a woman named Susanna and two children for more than $7,000. But what happened in South Carolina and Georgia happened in many places. That's why the U.S. State Department and National Park Service are bringing together experts from Brazil, Colombia, Ghana, Jamaica, Mozambique, Senegal, Sierra Leone, and South Africa. The goal is to develop strategies to protect slave-related sites from vandalism, theft, and other threats. Paul Chichman is director in charge of collections for the Iziko Museums of South Africa. It's important, he says, to protect and preserve slave trade sites.
Slavery has shaped our landscape, not only, you know, in the United States, but in South Africa, in other parts of Africa where people were taken to the Cape, taken to the Americas. And we have slave descendant communities. And it's important, I think, for people to know where they've come from.
Chichman says many challenges the world faces today were born of slavery.
We face issues of racism. We face issues of poverty that are linked as well to events that happened in the past.
He says it's taken a long time for the world to acknowledge what happened.
That's what's important about what we are engaged in. It's a humanizing project. It's bringing back humanity to people who have been robbed, in a sense, of their humanity. When you deny the humanity of other people, it does something to your own humanity.
Titchman is also curator of the Iziko Slave Trade Museum in Cape Town. In 1679, the Dutch East India Company erected the building to house enslaved people from Mozambique, Madagascar, Indonesia, and India. Another protected site in South Africa is actually underwater, off Clifton Beach in Cape Town. In 1794, a Portuguese slave ship bound for Brazil sank there, killing more than 200 Mozambicans. The 200 or so who survived were sold to local farmers. Another delegate to the Charleston, South Carolina workshop is Isatu Smith, chairperson of Sierra Leone's Monuments and Relics Commission. She's also the former deputy coordinator of the Bunce Island Coalition. Many thousands of enslaved Africans were shipped from the small island in Freetown Harbor to South Carolina and Georgia.
I feel like we have a responsibility to preserve Bunce Island as a place of pilgrimage for descendants of these slaves whose ancestors most likely came to Bunce Island. We owe it to ourselves to preserve it as a shrine, as a site of memory and conscience, so that descendants can return to Bunce Island and see the place where their ancestors were most likely bought and sold.
Bunce Island has been visited by many African Americans tracing their ancestry.
I have myself taken a number of African Americans, and I have witnessed firsthand the raw, raw emotion. Fortunately for us, Ross Island is pretty well preserved after it was abandoned at the end of the slave trade. So when you go there, it's uninhabited, it's very silent and solemn.
Smith says there's a lesson to be learned from the former slave trade island.
That man must not be inhuman to man. That is one message that resonates with me when I go to Bones Island. When you hear about the way human beings bought and sold and treated fellow human beings just for in the sake of greed, was it worth it? How far are we prepared to go to get rich? That man must not be so desperate to become rich and famous that you're willing to treat your fellow human being as an animal.
The UN declared 2004 as the international year to commemorate the struggle against slavery and its abolition. Kuchira Matsura, then Director General of UNESCO, the UN Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, said ensuring universal awareness of the tragedy of the slave trade and slavery is an essential task, which has relevance not only for the past, but also for the present and the future. The U.S.-sponsored workshop in Charleston in April will focus on historic and archaeological site management. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The Arab and European Film Festival is underway. It features more than 30 films from 25 different countries and runs through March 12th. Noria Tesson has the story from Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt.
The Egyptian Sinai Peninsula was never more deserted of tourists than now. The ongoing unrest in the country and the rise of extremist groups in the region have ended the old good days when people from all over the world visit. Resorts and beaches look like dusty shadows now, but the Red Sea surroundings still look magnificent with its mountains and its coral reef. Sharm el-Sheikh is hosting the Arab and European Film Festival as it tries to portray itself as a town of peace and security, but it's not that easy. Abir Soliman is an official with the Noon Foundation for Culture and Arts, organizer of the festival.
The extremist actions that caused the severe drop in tourism here. So we are trying to help our country to spread the message that we are a country of peace. The security is intensive. Anybody cannot enter the governorate of South Sinai without checking, without permission, without hotel, without whatever reason to enter. So they became very strict to checking everybody, why they're here, for how long, and follow up with them. I sense that they feel the responsibility and they want to make this a great success, because at the end we are serving the governorate.
Egyptian authorities are focusing all their efforts these days in sowing an image of normality in Sharm el-Sheikh. There are photos of Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi claiming in different languages that this is the city of peace. But people know very little about what really happens in this region, and most of the European figures invited to the festival declined to attend. In the southern Sinai, where Sharm el-Sheikh is located, security measures have tightened ever since a plane carrying mostly Russian passengers was the target of a terrorist bomb. Journalists get little or no access to cover events in Sinai, especially in the northern part of the peninsula where the army wages an open war with terrorist groups, some of them linked to ISIS. Khaled Fouda is the governor of South Sinai.
I feel, you know, very good. I am, you know, the first one who gives them the opportunity to do it in Sharm el-Sheikh. I love, you know, this festival to be in Sharm el-Sheikh. But Sharm el-Sheikh is more than Bell City. It's beautiful city. It's wonderful. Most of the people in the world like to come to Sharm el-Sheikh. Would like to let them come back.
The festival will screen 30 films from 25 different countries in the long and short film competition. It was supposed to honor the Egyptian writer, activist and feminist Nawal Sadawi, the honorary president of the festival. But in the very last moments he was asked not to speak. Disappointed that Sadawi thinks that someone could be afraid of what she was going to say on stage, given her critical points of view about the government. But the show goes on, the lights turn off and the screening starts. The stage fills with singing and dancing, with Bedouin teenagers playing drums. Girls move around with embroidered abayas, resembling the underwater life of the Red Sea, fishes and seagrass. For them, the festival brings the hope of a new beginning, the return of the masses who used to flood their land, and a new opportunity to relaunch their businesses. For Voice of America, this is Nuria Tasson from San Jose.
As tuberculosis becomes increasingly resistant to existing antibiotics, soil could hold the key to new drugs. Scientists looking for new ways to treat disease are studying a microorganism found in dirt to develop a better antibiotic against the TB bacterium. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
Tuberculosis is one of the top 10 causes of death around the world. According to the World Health Organization, there are 10.4 million new cases of TB every year, killing 1.8 million people. Antibiotic resistance is to blame in a great many instances. In 2015, it was estimated that 480,000 infections were not responsive to two major drugs commonly used to treat TB. A 250,000 patients reportedly died of drug-resistant infections. An international team of researchers has been hunting for new sources of antibiotics in nature to treat deadly illnesses like tuberculosis. Investigators have hit upon a species of bacteria in a large family called Streptomyces found in soil. In the laboratory, they have extracted compounds from these microorganisms that target a very specific enzyme in Mycobacterium, the pathogen that causes TB. The enzyme is necessary for the bacterium to build its cell wall. Using synthetic chemistry, the researchers were able to recreate these compounds, turning them into more potent versions of the originals. Structural biology professor David Roper of England's University of Warwick, part of the international team that found Streptomyces, likens the enzymes to bones in the human body.
If you knock out our skeletons, you're not going to be a very competent human being, are you? So, and the same is true for the biosynthesis of the bacterial cell wall. It's exactly the same principle that penicillin inhibits, although that's a different enzyme, and other antibiotics like vancomycin, for example. So the biosynthesis of the bacterial cell wall is a good target for antibiotics.
The work was published in the journal Nature Communications. In the soil, Roper says the bacteria use the compounds to kill other microorganisms near them. This, he says, gives them a survival advantage.
One of the reasons for looking at natural product compounds in general is that these things have been derived from nature. Therefore, they've gone through many millennia years of evolution in the first place, and they've been retained by nature. So they must have, as it were, long-standing efficacy.
The challenge has been growing soil bacteria like Streptomyces in the lab. There's no timetable for turning soil bacteria into drugs against diseases like TB, but researchers note that it'll take time. And as new drugs from soil bacteria become available, Roper does not rule out that TB may become resistant to them too. But researchers have learned from their experience with tuberculosis that antibiotics must be used with great care to preserve their effectiveness. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss International Women's Day. It's also known as the United Nations Day for Women's Rights and International Peace. celebrating women's achievements throughout history. That's right here on the next Straight Talk Africa at 1830 UTC.